Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, and may be seated. First case on our calendar is 07996 VIL Laser Systems LLC versus Shiloh Industries, Inc. Mr. Warren.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Tom Warren on behalf of the appellants. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Your time there.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the question facing the court in this case is whether an order that gives a plaintiff a choice between two mutually exclusive and independent forms of relief constitutes a final order under Ohio law. Respectfully, we would submit that under Ohio law, given the remitted or jurisprudence of this court, given the collective wisdom of the courts across this country, and common sense, issues of finality all suggest that the answer to that question should be no. The only section of 2505.02 that is apparently at issue in this case is section B3. That is the section upon which VIL contends that this is a final appealable order, and that is the section upon which the trial court judge relied in deeming this to be a final appealable order. But section B3, which provides that an order that vacates or sets aside a judgment or grants a new trial, is a final order, while that is the language of the statutory section, this order did neither. It neither set aside a judgment because it could not set aside a judgment unless and until the plaintiff had consented to remitter. Under this court's remitter jurisprudence, it would have been invalid for the court to do that, and in fact, the trial court recognized that fact by indicating that his order setting aside the judgment was conditioned upon the plaintiff's acceptance. It also did not grant a new trial because it would only do that in the event that remitter was not accepted. And in fact, in this case, remitter ultimately was accepted, so no new trial was granted. VIL does not contend that section B1 applies here, and we agree.
When was the remitter accepted?
It was the original remitter was accepted on December 29th. Of 2006.
Is that what made the order final at that point?
Well, an argument can be made that the order was final at that point. I think an argument can also be made that the order is not yet final. From our client's perspective, whether the
You're telling us it's still not final and you're up here now.
That's correct, Your Honor. The argument would be that until and unless the trial court actually issues an order reflective of the decision that the plaintiff makes, if the plaintiff elects to consent to remitter, then the court should order a judgment consistent with Rule 58 that reflects the amended or remitted judgment amount.
The simple solution would seem to be that, and it's not nowhere, and it's not in statute or rule, but it would be that the trial judge, when the party makes his or her decision of one of the two options, that the trial court just puts on an entry indicating that that's the option that's been chosen. That's the entry, and from that date, then everything begins to the time begins to run. That would be the most efficient way to approach this issue, would it not? Or is there?
I agree, Your Honor. I mean, whether the court issues an actual order pursuant to it, or just enters a minute order or a journal entry to that effect. In either case, that would effectuate Rule 58. It would clarify for purposes of the proceedings what the actual order of the court was, whether it was a judgment in the form of a remitter or an order granting a new trial.
Counselor, why can't the entry that's at issue here be viewed as an order subject to a condition subsequent that the court granted a new trial, and unless the party accepted the remitter, and then they filed their notice saying they did. So that the order was in effect, and all that remained to be done was whether the party accepted the remitter and thereby waived the new trial. Why would that not be proper?
I mean, I think the answer to that question is that under Ohio law, a judgment for remitter can't be entered until the plaintiff consents. So I think it would be a misreading of this court's opinion in the Whiteman case and this court's jurisprudence indicating that remitter cannot be entered until and unless the plaintiff consents to remitter. So I think it would be inconsistent to deem the December 15th date, the date of the original order, to be the date upon which the judgment was entered for purposes of calculating the 30-day time rule. Indeed, Judge Welbaum in this case, in his order, indicated that judgment would be entered upon the consent of the plaintiff. And so it is, I believe, correctly reflective of this court's remitter jurisprudence. I think it is important for the court to...
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Once the verdict was in, what was the best possible outcome for your client at that point?
Well, there was a judgment on the jury verdict, and at that point, one of the things that my client appealed was the summary judgment on liability. So in the notice of appeal, we were contesting summary judgment on liability as well as the judgment upon jury verdict.
So then you would have been appealing even if they had rejected remitter.
And
a new trial had been ordered.
It's possible. I mean, another thing that my client could have done if the court had granted a new trial, of course, was to let the new trial go forward and see what the result of the trial was.
Because I was thinking new trial is your best possible outcome because you got hammered by the jury. So you would be sitting there and saying, well, if it's a new trial, we don't want to appeal. But what you're telling us is you would have wanted to appeal anyway.
Well, not necessarily at that point. So if the court had ordered a new trial, it's certainly conceivable and probably likely that my client would have elected to see what happened in the new trial before deciding whether or not to contest the other various issues that had been litigated, including on summary judgment. It might have mooted out that point.
If they had accepted new trial, could you have appealed at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, it explains somewhat of the conundrum that I think a defendant is placed in this situation, which is if a trial court gives a plaintiff a window of time to decide whether to accept remitter, and a defendant waits until that, and that constitutes a final order, let's say hypothetically it does, and then the defendant waits to see what the result is to decide whether or not they're going to file a notice of appeal or not, then effectively the window of time for the defendant to make a decision about whether to file a notice of appeal shrinks from 30 days to whatever that new time period is. In this case, it would have been 16 or 18 days or something to that effect. And it is not enough to say that the defendant could file a prophylactic notice of appeal, because there are implications to filing a prophylactic notice of appeal.
What was the court order that you appealed from on January 25th of 07?
We appealed from the summary judgment order on liability, the judgment on jury verdict, and I believe two other earlier orders.
Which was that? What date was that entered?
The judgment on jury verdict was entered on September 18th of 2006, Your Honor.
And you appealed that on January 25th?
That's one of the orders that's referenced in the notice of appeal, Your Honor, yes.
How could you appeal a final order in September in January?
The phrasing of the notice of appeal was that all of the prior interlocutory orders in the case were made final on January 16th and were subsumed within the notice of appeal. If I may, Your Honor.
To go back to Justice Pfeiffer's question,
yes.
Your notice of appeal isn't on the question of the finality of the remitter. It's on the summary.
Well, again, our appeal, we were not appealing the remitter. In that case, we were appealing various other aspects of the case. It was the plaintiff in this case that appealed the remitter. And the reason that the plaintiff, so we're here because of the issue of when the 30 days ran. If a defendant in a case like this is forced to make a prophylactic notice of appeal, the implications of that under Whiteman are that that then enables the plaintiff to file a cross appeal contesting the remitter. Now, when this court adopted the Wisconsin rule in the Whiteman case, that, you know, it is this court's jurisprudence that a plaintiff is not permitted to file to appeal a remitter unless and until a defendant files an initial appeal. And by filing a prophylactic notice of appeal, what that does is it enables a plaintiff to appeal a remitter under circumstances in which they otherwise wouldn't necessarily be entitled to do so. So either the defendant has a contracted period of time for which to file a notice of appeal, which is inconsistent with Rule 4A, or Whiteman is undermined. And I would note, Your Honor, that if this order was a final appealable order, I think a reasonable question to ask is whether or not the plaintiff at that point would be entitled to appeal. Now, it is true that under Whiteman, a plaintiff cannot appeal the acceptance of a remitter, but this order says you have a choice between one of two options. Now, if the order is not final until the acceptance at a minimum, then conceivably the plaintiff could appeal that order before having to accept the remitter, which would then completely undermine Whiteman because they would not be precluded from appealing the remitter. They could appeal.
So your basic argument is to why you should persuade us to go your way today is it helps plaintiffs.
Well, I think that it undermines finality. It undermines finality, and it's inconsistent with the language of 2505.02.
I want to take you back to one other thing. You said you believe there's no final order on in this case yet, right?
I think that is an argument that can be made, Your Honor. It's certainly our position.
You just made it a couple minutes ago. If that's the case, if we persuaded by your arguments and the outcome went your way, what do we do with this case?
Well, if you believe, and Your Honor, I want to run well into my rebuttal time, so if I may answer your question, and it depends. If this court believes that there needs to be an order or a journal entry reflecting the acceptance of the remitter, then I believe that a remand to the Court of Common Pleas is appropriate for the entry of such an order. If the order became effective upon the acceptance of remitter, automatically conditioned, as Justice Kopp was indicating, conditioned upon the acceptance of the remitter, then I think that a remand to the Third District, reversing the Third District's determination that Shiloh's appeal was untimely, would be appropriate.
The acceptance of the remitter was, how was that, was it conveyed to the court by letter, or how?
There was a filing of a notice to consent to remitter, Your Honor.
Okay, and I supposing you got notice of that, I assume, right?
Your Honor.
There's no formal procedure for, or maybe there is there a formal procedure for one indicating, a party indicating that it wants to accept a remitter?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I believe that this was done through filing, although I must admit I am not aware of a formal procedure for that to happen.
So if the notice of, if the 30 days is to begin from the filing of the notice, that's different than 30 days beginning from the filing of an entry by the court.
That's true. Under the first circumstance, we would be within the 30 days that started on December 29th, and in the second case, there would still be no ultimate final appealable order in this case. So the notice of appeal would be premature. But in either situation, my client's notice of appeal would be timely, either within the 30 days or premature.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. Mr. Thiemann.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Jim Thiemann. We have a narrow issue before us today, and that is, when does the 30-day appeal clock begin? We submit it begins on December 15. They say on one of three other dates. I think it's important for us to compare the practical effect of these two different approaches. First of all, with regard to the December 15th order, the criticism is that they were not on notice that that was a final order triggering their 30-day period. It certainly appears to be a final order, resolves all the issues. As far as Judge Walbaum was concerned, he had finished his work.
Well, if they wanted to, go ahead, Chief.
Go ahead. Okay.
If they'd wanted to appeal, would they be appealing the remittiture or the new trial?
They would be filing. They could have appealed or waited. They would have had 30 days to do so. They would be appealing. They would be appealing the December 15 judgment, no doubt, and they would have been timely. But the December 15 judgment, in our way of thinking, is a self-executing order. In other words, subject to a condition subsequent. All matters were resolved in that ruling. It complies with Civil Rule 58.
But a court cannot grant a remittiture without the consent of a party. It is without the authority to sua sponte grant a remittiture.
You are correct.
So there is an additional element that needs to be completed before that becomes a final act.
There is an additional element, but it's not an action by a court. It's an action by a litigant. It's consent. And as a consent, it is not an order. It's not journalized. It's not signed by a judge. It's not a decision. It's not compliant with Rule 58. However, the December 15 order is compliant with Rule 58.
But Mr. Thiemann, it doesn't say judgment is entered. It says judgment shall be entered. So, I mean, the terms of the order itself say that the entry, the judgment, shall take effect upon the consent of the plaintiff. Doesn't that, by its own terms, suggest that the order will take effect in the future, not at the present?
Yes. Because it says shall take effect. I can't argue with that. I can say it's inartful. I can say that the order, by its terms, intends to resolve all the issues.
Well, if it said judgment is entered, is, presently, you'd have a different argument. But when you see the shall be, I mean, the intent of the order is for the future.
And perhaps that's in deference to the Whiteman case that says that we must consent to remittiture before remittiture is effective, mm-hmm. which we did. In a timely fashion. We submit that when you have to compare, the 1215 order may be criticized in certain respects, but the alternatives are worse. The alternatives they suggest are three. First of all, they say it should be the consent. Well, the consent doesn't comply with Rule 58 because it's not a decision by a judge, it's not signed by a judge, and it's not journalized. Well, how about the expiration of time? The expiration of time is another proposal they make. In other words, if you don't consent, your time to do so expires on December 29. That's even worse. There's no entry for that expiration of time. It's not signed by a judge. It's not journalized. It doesn't comply with Rule 58.
What's wrong with requiring judges who enter an order like this from once the consent is granted to the remittiteur? Or the other alternative is then put on an entry that says, okay, you now have a judgment for X dollars, which is the remittiture, or you now have an order for a new trial. It seems to me that you argue that the judge has done everything the judge needs to do. It doesn't seem complete. There are issues pending. There's two major issues pending. What are damages? That's not resolved. New trial, that's a huge issue for a trial judge. So it seems to me the cleanest, simplest way is you exercise remittiture or choose the new trial, then the judge puts on the entry that accepts either choice. It's a clear date. Everybody knows the date. They can appeal from the date. Because when you pick the date you talk about as the conditional order, what do you appeal? Do you appeal the fact that the court gave you a choice when you don't know what the choice is yet? You don't know if you're even going to want to appeal yet?
You, that is the third alternative they present, and that there needs to be a subsequent order approving the consent.
That really resolves all these issues, doesn't it? That just makes it very simple. Mm-hmm. Trial court, the party makes its decision, trial court puts on an entry, and the time begins to run. That just seems like, to me, the most efficient and the fairest way to resolve this issue. What's wrong with that?
It is a consent to a consent so that the first consent is effective. It doesn't amount to a decision. It's an acknowledgement. You might as well have judges acknowledge jury demands or precipices for subpoenas or court cost deposits.
But the other party doesn't know whether it wants to appeal until the plaintiff here has made its decision.
Perhaps, but not in this case, because if you look at the notice.
But we write law for not just the facts before it. We try to write law that applies to across the board other cases, and so we have to be sensitive to that, it seems to me, in this case.
Yes, you have to be sensitive to the practicalities. But in this particular case, they appealed the motion for summary judgment ruling, venue, a chance to reply to some other motion, and the judgment itself of September 18th. They didn't appeal any of these other orders. They're not mentioned in their appeal.
Counsel,
were you finished with your answer to my question?
I'm sorry.
Yes, you do. They still have time to appeal, and they can file a premature notice of appeal under Rule 4. That might not be the most desirable situation. But the problem with doing a subsequent approval is you don't find that anywhere in 2505.02. You don't find that anywhere in Civil Rule 58, which talks about decisions.
There's a gap here, admittedly. There's a gray area we have to fill in somehow.
Yes.
You're right about that.
It isn't a decision at all, I guess. Really, it really goes back to the single theory that it is a self-executing order. When Judge Welbaum signed that order, as far as he was concerned, he was finished with this case, and everybody knew where they stood. And all they were waiting for is either our consent or the expiration of time and a new trial. That wasn't Judge Welbaum's decision. That was our decision.
Counsel, with respect to the case itself, you got a verdict of what? It was 2.3, and when the judge put on the order for remitted or a new trial, he said something about post-judgment interest too, didn't he?
Yes, the 2.3 became 2.7 million and then was remitted to 1.8 and then interest added.
So he made all the calculations necessary to complete the case.
He did.
With that entry. And when you submitted the case to the jury, what was your ask?
They actually gave us a bit more than we asked.
Okay. So, what did you ask the jury?
We asked the jury for 2.2. Right. And they are 2.25, I believe. But there was a rationale to award 2.3.
I'm not questioning that. What I'm getting at is it wasn't brain surgery to know that you were going to accept the remitter rather than risk a new trial.
That's true.
Correct?
Correct.
I mean, if you're working on this case, you know what's coming next if you're the defendant.
That's right.
And there was a time limit on the acceptance of the remitter.
14 days.
So they're going to know for sure within the 30 days of
it was when, filed and served. Yes, sir.
And you would acknowledge there were issues that they were contesting hotly.
The motion for summary judgment was a concern.
With the summary judgment and all of that. I'm trying to work through the harm to the defendant that results from not preparing for an appeal based on the December 15th.
We submit that the December 15 order should have placed them on notice that at least had the earmarks of a final order. It resolved all the issues as far as the court had
concerned. When you accepted the remitter, did you do that in letter form or?
No, sir. We filed a one sentence, we consent to remitter in the amount of
case style and all of that.
Yes, sir.
So when you said it wasn't journalized.
Well, journalization, as I understand, is a term of art. They journalize judges' decisions, not lawyers' consents.
Right. But it's in the case file.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. It's in the appendix, too.
And copies to the defendant and all of,
yes,
all of,
yes,
that.
Nobody's contended service. They didn't get that. You are correct.
So you maintain we should ignore the judge's statement in his entry, that judgment to be entered upon. I mean, it sounds to me that even the entry itself said, once you do X or Y, then I will enter final judgment. Because I was a trial judge for a long time, and I have a hard time understanding how there's no issues to be resolved. To me, there's two huge issues to be resolved. You don't have damages completed. You don't have a final judgment entry on damages because you just have a statement that says, I'll do X or Y. And so once you file your notice remitter, as a trial judge, I always then put on a judgment entry saying that this is now the judgment. Or if they didn't take it, you now have a new trial. There was a subsequent act I always did, whether there's a gap in the law or not, that put everybody on notice this is the final judgment entry. You even have the judge himself saying this is not a final entry, judgment to be entered. What do we do with that statement? It's in your own entry that you're trying to say is final.
I would submit that when Judge Welbaum wrote that, it was in deference to Whiteman, which holds, of course, that you can't have remitter until we consent.
And you admit that your consent is not a judge's order.
It is not.
So the judge needed to do something else once you filed your consent.
Not if the December 15 order is self-executing.
And that's our decision.
And you say, well, there's a couple of very important things to be decided. And that really, there's alternative things. Are you going to take that amount of judgment, or are you going to have a new trial? But neither by the judge, only by us. And by the close of business on December 29th, that decision was made, and everybody knew that.
But it seems just natural then the judge would follow up and say, okay, you've made your election. Here's now the final judgment entry that I said was going to come.
Yeah, and he never did that. And probably in recognition that it wasn't necessary, at least from our way of thinking, it wasn't necessary.
The counsel, there's been reference to the judgment entry saying that there's going to be something more to come. But as I'm looking at the judgment entry, and I wonder if this is what you're referring to, just before his signature, it says judgment is granted to plaintiffs in the total amount of $2,016,000 in the manner set forth above. It is so ordered. Is that what you're referring to as being the final judgment?
It was a sum certain. Everybody knew it. Yes, sir. And that, it, to some extent, is inconsistent with the previous language, but it is the language at the end of the order, and it also states that this is final. Now,
that
doesn't make it so, but it says it.
But that was also not then the final judgment. Even though that entry says 2.3 is the final judgment, it's not the final judgment because you accepted a remitter. Correct?
We accepted.
$2.3 million is not the final judgment, correct?
The amount stated was the.
It was the jury verdict.
The jury verdict was 2.3.
Well, okay, the amount stated in the entry that was just read to you ended up not being the final judgment because you took a remitter, correct?
We took remitter,
so
yes.
Even that judgment entry is not final because it stated an incorrect amount.
I'm not sure from recollection what amount is in there. It isn't incorrect, though. Nobody's contended there's an inconsistency in the internal
to the order. No, but it wasn't the final judgment. What he just read you is the entry from the judge said this is the final judgment, $2.3 million.
No, it did not say that. We'd have to look at the record, but it didn't say it was $2.3 million. Because the only issue left remaining was you either accept remitted or you get a new trial. And the amount stated in there was a certain amount. We'd have to look and see exactly what that says. Whatever criticisms can be made about the December 15 order, we submit that it's better than the alternative, which is either a consent or an expiration or an approval, none of which are compliant with Civil Rule 58. And if the defense did not recognize the December 15 order as final, what makes you think they're going to recognize a consent or the expiration of time?
Mr. Thiemann, how would your client be hurt if the judge then sent a new entry saying that the consent was accepted or the new trial was accepted? In other words, what is the harm for us to say that the judge needs to do that final act? You say that the alternative is a negative. How is it a negative?
You, of course, could order that, but it isn't found or supported by 250502 or Civil Rule 58 because it's not a decision by a trial court. It's not a decision.
Putting aside the statute and the rule, and I think as the Chief Justice noted, we have a gap in both. What would be the harm if we were to articulate this rule that the judge needs to do one more step?
Well, I think you would take an area that is fairly complicated sometimes as it is, final appealable orders, and make it even more complicated because you would not find your rule anywhere in the statute, nor would you find it in a rule. You better know about this case, and you better know about the holding of this case. Now, everybody is supposed to know those holdings, but still, when you'd have to be able to find it and say, okay, now you have to expect the trial judge to know that, revisit it, and issue the order. That may never come. Because as far as Judge Welbaum, I submit, as far as Judge Welbaum is concerned, when he signed that order, he was finished with this case. The decision was now the litigant's, not his. So I'd submit that would be the harm is maybe it'll never happen, or will the parties be aware of this requirement? Will it actually happen, or will you again have premature appeals? I mean, the approval itself is not found in 250502. That is not 250502 doesn't list approvals of remitter after accepted by plaintiffs. That's not one of the seven listed grounds.
You've used your time, Mr. Thiemann.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Warren, you've saved 31 seconds of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Pfeiffer, I thought I might just look at your question about the effect on defendants. We see the prejudice to defendants in several ways. First of all, depending upon the window of time that the judge gives to the plaintiff to decide, it effectively narrows the amount of time for the defendant to make an intelligent decision about whether to appeal or not. And if they have to appeal before that date, they might it's a waste of attorney and judicial resources and might allow the plaintiff to appeal an otherwise unappealable acceptance of remitter.
Do you agree that the non pro tunc does not change the appeal time?
Because
the Court of Appeals, separate from your underlying issue. I mean, that could be a new start date that you would like. Do you agree there's jurisprudence that indicates that doesn't extend the appeal time?
Actually, Your Honor, it is our position that because the trial court designated the order as an amended order, and I would note actually stated at the bottom of the amended order, which was identical in most respects except for the calculation of prejudgment interest, but actually issued the amended order as an amended order as opposed to a non-pro-tunc order. And it was our position in our memo in support of jurisdiction to this court that was a separate error of the Third District in saying that did not renew the clock for the 30-day time period. Okay. This court elected not to accept jurisdiction on that particular issue. But we certainly believe that in the mix of things that were going on at the trial court level, it added to the confusion about the notice of appeal date.
Just to quickly, because your time's up, but to clear up some confusion, Justice Kupp pointed to the fact, and I assume you would agree, that the December 15th entry actually calculated and was an entry for $2,016,416, which takes into account the remitter and the prejudgment interest as the judge calculated it. So
yes,
from that standpoint, the judge here apparently was attempting to wrap it all up and put a ribbon around it in terms of the final number.
Yes, well, in one respect, Your Honor, I would agree that the amount that is reflected in the order of $2 million and change is, in fact, the remitted amount. But I would note that the order itself has inherent inconsistencies in it, in that it is an attempt to finalize something which, at another place in that same opinion, reflects the fact that it cannot do so. It would be a per se invalid order of the court to enter that judgment until and unless the plaintiff consented to it, as is reflected in the other language of the order. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.